Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, 2003. Today's session is Savior of the Salvage Yard, Session 2 of Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus, presented by Steve Ringo. The number is RIS 2003-02. Let's listen in.
A land for you, so if that seems confusing a little bit, that means you maybe weren't here yesterday. That's okay. You might just figure some things out, but I did make a standing offer yesterday too for anybody that wants to go up to the third level. I'm going to make another trip tomorrow. So
what time are you going tomorrow?
Well, it would be in the... Well, raise your hand if you're interested, because we could choose. Okay? Would morning or afternoon be better for those who raise their hands?
Morning.
Is there a consensus?
Morning's cooler?
Yeah, morning's cooler. Let's go in the morning. How about... I haven't looked at what sessions are on there, but... we'll just pick a time? 9 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay, let's say 9 o'clock at the loading dock here, and then bring some good walking shoes, and we'll walk the longer route because it's easier. And today we brought up a cart, one of those luggage carts, and I felt like I was back in China where I used to work in the Republic of China, and so many things are done by human labor, but we were just laboring with this old rickety cart. And these are the things we found today, so later on if you want to come and look, this was maybe my favorite find. I put it up here in the middle, but I have a hunch this used to be on top of like a furnace or some kind of a smokestack, maybe, but something needs to be done with that.
Yeah, a chandelier or...
Right. And then this probably was on some kind of a tractor or machine of some sort. I'm not sure if I can get it back on there, but we'll just go like that. And I didn't arrange any of this in any permanent fashion, but and Bretta actually did a lot of the arranging. This was another one of my favorites. And this piece actually was connected to that, but I think this is kind of it's very heavy. Standalone piece. I don't know if you find any pleasure in looking at that, but I do. I think it's kind of ready made.
That's great.
Ready to wear. Even the backside is kind of cool. There are two mental hospitals in this. I made a little oath to myself that we would get through more poems today than we did yesterday, so let's
do
that.
Excuse me, yes? You think you're going to leave at 9 o'clock to go up to the dump?
And level 3.
Level 3, 9 a.m.
Whatever it's called. 9 a.m.?
Yeah.
And you're going to be back here for class at 10:45.
That was my class at 10:45. That's why we need to do it in the afternoon.
The daytimer.
I knew there was a reason. Thanks. Thanks, Jean. We should do it after lunch then. So 1:30. Is that okay? We'll discuss it tomorrow at class, but I'm planning to go in the afternoon then. It takes a good 20 to 30 minutes to get up there using the more traversable method, and a good downhill coming back. But if you have stuff, if you want, or if you bring a camera too. Dale, right? Dale's been bringing his camera up there, and there's some fun ways to do camera work if you want to. But that's up to you. Just tag along if you wish. Recap shows us what? Three articles, right? Maker, Redeemer. And I think I thought about this at 5:30 a.m. this morning when I first woke up before I got to sleep. Sanctification is just too vague. We just left that word dangling out there, and hopefully we'll come back to that. But so few people know it, or care maybe what that means. But anyway, first article, second article, third article, and we kind of wanted to use these yesterday as we go through the next several sessions to use as kind of code hooks. to hang your coat on. Is this thought more related to creation? Is this thought in that poem more related to redemption or salvation or liberation? Is this poem and this thought or that picture more related to the Spirit and the Church? Yeah.
This morning at his session, Herb Chelstrom, Grinsager was asking for different translations or words to describe the third person of the Trinity. And we have a whole list on the board. And helper, friend, one who stands beside, were some of the favorite ones of that group, finally, as we talked about it. But we were working on that third article, trying to think of other words besides sanctifier that would be meaningful to us today.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Mm-hmm. The mysterious Spirit, yeah, hard to pin down. Does everybody have the handout? So today, what I'm leading up to there is second article concerns, as they might say in theological discourse. Second article stuff. And let's go ahead and start with the poem at the beginning, The Ballad of Orange and Grape, which I actually chose for Christine a couple months ago because of her New York connection, by Muriel Rukeyser. So look, as we read this, I'll read this one. Look for words you like, we talked about, lines you might like, and what connection does this poem have to Redeemer, salvation, liberation? And don't have to think about Jesus in that, it might distract you from seeing the other images. Jesus tends to show up anyway, so here we go. Ballad of Orange and Grape. After you finish your work, after you do your day, after you've read your reading, after you've written your say, you go down the street to the hot dog stand, one block down and across the way, on a blistering afternoon in East Harlem in the 20th century. Most of the windows are boarded up. The rats run out of a sack, sticking out of the crummy garage, one shiny, long Cadillac at the glass door of the drug addiction center. A man who'd like to break your back. But here's a brown woman with a little girl dressed in rose and pink, too. Frankfurters sizzle on the steel, where the hot dog man leans. Nothing else on the counter but the usual two machines, the grape one empty and the orange one empty. I face him in between. A black boy comes along, looks at the hot dogs, goes on walking. I watch the man as he stands and pours in the familiar shape, bright purple in the one marked orange, orange in the one marked grape. Here you have the title, don't you? The grape drink in the machine marked orange, and the orange drink in the grape. Just the one word, large and clear, unmistakable on each machine. I ask him, how can we go on reading and make sense out of what we read? How can they write and believe what they're writing, the young ones across the street, while you go on pouring grape into orange and orange into the one marked grape? How are we going to believe what we read and what we read and we write and we hear and we say and we do? He looks at the two machines and he smiles and he shrugs and smiles and pours again. It could be violence and nonviolence. It could be black. It could be white and black, women and men. It could be war and peace or any binary system. Love and hate, enemy, friend, yes and no, be and not be, what we do and what we don't do. On a corner in East Harlem, garbage, reading, a deep smile, rape, forgetfulness, a hot street of murder, misery, withered hope. A man keeps pouring grape into orange and orange into the one marked grape. Pouring orange into grape, and grape into orange forever. Makes you want to say amen. Okay, talk to me about, what do you think? Impressions, simple things, or deeper a line you liked, a word you liked.
Well, in New York, it would be orange.
Okay. I'm a Seattle.
Orange.
Now, would that rhyme with anything in here that I did?
That's, I was watching that. Uh-huh. I'm not sure it would.
Okay.
It's just silly.
Yeah, that's good to know.
Isn't that one of the English words that doesn't rhyme with anything?
Yeah.
Sort of a hopeless treadmill, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. The treadmill. There is some hopelessness here.
It doesn't make any difference to him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like nobody cares. They expect it to be that way. So.
Okay.
I saw beauty in his smile and shrug.
Okay.
So not just resignation.
Okay. That's a good discussion there, isn't it? Is it resignation, or is it just freedom from, I'm going to rise above that. Okay, lady, if you want that to be an issue, fine. But to me, it's just, this is no matter, it's orange there. You can see it's orange, right? Or you can see it's great. I like the way her face is framed in between the two vessels of the beverages. But yeah, resignation or hope, resignation or freedom, that's great.
Puzzling and confusing labels.
Okay.
About everything.
Yeah. Okay. Especially in that second to last stanza, where all the dualities and the dualisms come up between what men, women, violence, nonviolence, war, peace, love, hate, enemy, friend, yes, no, be, not be, you know, life, death, existence. She covers a whole gamut there, doesn't she? But in a way, he's just, either he's way above it or he's resigned to this treadmill. I think the reader has some choices.
I think this is how he asserts his individualism, control.
Mm-hmm. The beverage, the
server. Right.
The server.
He creates his own sets of, mm-hmm. set of rules there. I'll put the orange and the gray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking it was confounding, it's how we can confound each other.
Yeah, right. That's good too. Uh-huh. I think maybe I chose this one to set it up. To set up this whole need of the question of the need for redemption, the need for liberation, the need for what is our need? Whenever somebody says, "I'm saved by the blood of the Lamb," or "I'm saved," or "Are you saved?" Those sort of questions. And a lot of times that you hear people say, "Well, what from what? Well, from sin." You know, that's the easy, but that's too simple, isn't it? What is this salvation about? Is it all about eternal life? And so I'm using this to sort of set that up and explore some of those questions as we go through some of these other poems. He does mention garbage in there, though, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. That's why he's going in.
Pardon?
That's why he got in the book, because he mentioned
right.
She. Christine?
I was wondering about it being called a ballad.
The story, yeah. Is it?
What that genre of poetry or so on.
It's being more of a story, huh?
Is it more of a story, kind
of? Yeah,
it's a story.
A ballad should have a narrative.
And it rhymes A-B.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There is.
But then he throws in that final line in each stanza that throws.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
Yeah.
He's thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
I like it that he smiles. He's not just depressed about these confusing labels, but he's able to kind of smile about it.
The vendor. The vendor, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's under control.
Yeah, he's under control.
He's controlling something in this nebulous area.
And everything around him is sort of just going on its own, sometimes terrible and sometimes good way.
But she also, I mean, she, the writer, mm-hmm. the poet, she sets up this problem, which is that apparently what she does is she reads and writes.
Mm, right.
And so then she runs into this paradox,
right.
The orange and grape, and she, in a certain sense, she's asking him to save her from this problem. She's got an existential
issue. Right, I agree.
Issue.
Beautifully stated, I like that. I think that goes back to what Christine's asking about the ballad, that the whole life of this part of the city is structured around this, her question about existence and writing and how to label things and how to make things clear and how to redeem this world.
Is what
change.
I do worth what? I mean,
right.
If I can walk out into the street and have reading and writing be mm-hmm. meaningless.
Right. How can I make meaning or make it meaningful? And then it becomes everybody's ballad in her mind. She creates it as a ballad for the whole of East Harlem. Well, great. You're great poetry readers. I can see that. That's wonderful. Shall we go to the next one? And then we're going to jump around after that a little bit in here. Who would like to read Shakespeare, a sonnet? Anybody that's got a yen for that?
Yeah,
or what's your name again?
Julian.
Julian. Julian's going to read sonnets.
My wife volunteered.
Yeah.
First sonnet. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. And me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away. Death's second self that seals up all in rest, and me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth die, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was, with which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long.
Okay. Fairly familiar sonnet, probably. What impressions or meanings come out for you? How about a repeated word or theme? Easy one.
Thou.
Thou, okay. Meaning yeah. You. Everybody. Death.
Death.
That's the right answer.
I said that.
Thank you for playing. Oh, I didn't hear you. Sorry. Death is over and over. And in many of the sonnets, death. Dylan Thomas once said that all the real themes in literature are love and death. That love and death is not much else. And if you test that against the things you read, that's fairly true. And then you might start to see, if you test that, it's kind of fun to see what are all these various subcategories of themes under the theme of death and under the theme of life. But here he's saying, if we look at the last two lines, to love that, this thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must love ere long, there's the word thou.
Leave.
I'm sorry. Which thou must leave, in other words, death. What does this have to do with salvation? I think a few things. Anybody? What? Before I say it, what do you think?
Well, death is inevitable, and you have to die before you.
Okay. Is salvation just about what happens
after life,
after
no.
death?
No.
A lot of Christians, and Shakespeare isn't a preacher, though some could say so. I think there's a sense that it's on loan, that this life, you have what you have now, take it. This is sort of a seize the day thing, in a way, because you know it's going to end. So here you have this life that's on loan to you, and to claim it that way. But also there's the consumed, and I think this is where a note of healing comes in for me, consumed with that which it was nourished by. What do you make of that? Consumed with that which it was nourished by, that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire.
And that, for me, a puzzling line, death's second self that seals up all the rest.
All in rest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was puzzling to me.
Which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest.
Is that sleep?
Yes.
I think
night.
So.
Black night.
Death, black night, and sleep, maybe?
Yeah,
the light by black night takes away something, and that is death's second self. Another, you get a foretaste of death by looking at how black night comes.
And going to sleep, maybe? You think
some of that sleep, Maury?
Yeah.
In me that thou seest the glowing of such fire. It goes back to that, the fire as an echo of the sun, again, the sun and the light and dark, maybe, that on the ashes of his youth. I have a hunch, maybe I'm wrong, that consumed with that which it was nourished by is a little bit like what Rethke said that about being food for worms, that when we die, we nourish. That, you know, we were once nourished by the earth as we eat of it, but then we nourish the ground, and when we die and rot away, there's this, Walt Whitman talks about it in a poem called This Compost, that, you know, it's appalling to watch. He stumbles on this compost pile, and it's just, ew, you know, somebody said gunk yesterday. It's just hot and stinky and all that, but all of a sudden he realizes it's wow, you know, this is life, and it's eating, it's the life and death intermingled.
And death is life, right? I mean, I think I'm just saying what you're saying, but there's no eternity, which is, this isn't about actual death, but this is about a transition from a fiery youth to a middle age, in which the passions of youth right. are a little bit deadened, mm-hmm. and he's having to accept the fact that he's entering another stage in his life, and then seeing that, there is a redemption in just seeing that.
Well, so is he consumed by the passions of his youth, which also were what nourished
him? Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There you go. I like that. Sure.
Because he isn't gone yet. Mm-hmm. But on the ashes of his youth, that's why, as the death that one must describe, consumed that particular thing.
Yeah. I do think that there's there's probably too much emphasis on otherworldly heaven in a most this afterlife thing when we talk about salvation. I think in the Christian tradition, there's, you know, what about this day-to-day thing too, you know, this transforming into other parts of life and how you nourish and feed others or are nourished and fed yourself as you go through this life here. So let's go to the next point. I guess I am going in order because I really do want this one next. Has anyone read this?
I was reading it.
Would you like to read it?
Sure.
Out loud?
Sure. Fear. We were afraid of everything. Earthquakes, strangers, smoke above the canyon, the fire that would come running and eat up our house. The Claymore girls, big-boned, rough razor blades tucked in their ratted hair. We were terrified of polio, tuberculosis, being found out, the tent full of boys 2 blocks over, the kickball, the asphalt, the pain-filled rocks, the glass-littered canyon, the deep cave gouged in its side, the wheelbarrow crammed with dirty magazines, beer cans, spit-laced butts. We were afraid of hands, screen doors slammed by angry mothers, abandoned cars, their slumped back seats, a chain link fence we couldn't climb fast enough, electrical storms, blackouts, girl fights behind the pancake house, original sin, sidewalk cracks in the corner crematorium, loose brakes on the handlebars of our bikes. It came alive behind our eyes, ant mounds, wasps' nests, the bird half eaten on the scratchy grass, chained dogs, the boggy creek bed, the sewer main that fed it, the game where you had to hold your breath until you passed out. We were afraid of being poor, dumb, yelled at, ignored, invisible, as the nuclear dust we were told to wipe from lids before we opened them in the kitchen, the fat roll of meat that slid into the pot, sleep, dreams, the soundless swing of the father's ringed fist, the mother's face turned away, the wet bed, anything red, the slow leak, the stain on the driveway, oily gears soaking in a shallow pan, busted chairs stuffed in the rafters of the neighbor's garage, the Chevy twisted undersides jacked up on blocks, wrenches left scattered in the dirt. It was what we knew best, understood least. It whipped through our bodies like fire or sleet. We were lured by the dumpster behind the liquor store, fissures in the baked earth, the smell of singed hair, the brassy hum of high-tension towers, train tracks, buzzards over a ditch, black widows, the cat with one eye, the red spot on the back of the skirt, the fallout shelter's metal door hinged to the rusty grass, the back way, the wrong path, the night's wide back, the coiled bedsprings of the sister's top bunk, the wheezing, the cousin in the next room tapping on the wall, anything small. We were afraid of clothesline, curtain rods, the worn hairbrush, the good-for-nothings we were about to become, reform school, the long ride to the ocean on the bus, the man at the back of the bus, the underpass. We were afraid of fingers, of pickleweed crawling over the embankment, the French kiss, the profound silence of dead fish, burning sand, rotting elastic in the waistbands of our underpants, jellyfish, riptides, eucalyptus bark unraveling, the pink flesh beneath, the stink of seaweed, seagulls landing near our feet, their hateful eyes, their orange-tipped beaks stabbing the sand, the crumbling edge of the continent we stood on, waiting to be saved, the endless, wind-driven waves.
Thank you. So the title is Fear, and it's a litany, a listing, just unrelenting, which matches the mood of the poem and the title of the poem, this unrelenting listing of things that have been fears of hers, right? Say something about how you respond to a poem like this.
It's worse than the fearmonger shop.
Yeah. Garrison Keillor has his fearmonger shop in the Prairie Home Companion where they sell products catering to fear, right? For the people that get to the theater and are afraid their lights are still on or so forth. Yeah.
I don't know. I thought there was a little bit, I found myself chuckling at a lot of it though and finding a lot that I could identify with.
Sure.
And I thought, gee, she might have grown up about, I don't know how old this author is, about the same time I did. Hmm. I remember, a lot of things being afraid of when you're a kid just because right. You don't understand it, you don't know much about it.
True, for children. Mm-hmm. I think there is a lot that comes from childhood, isn't there, or adolescence.
It makes me think of that coming of age, but that coming of age has this little attraction to it, mm-hmm. or something that I miss when I hear all this. Mm-hmm. I think I have purposely decided to ignore the things that I don't understand anymore. But they're just listing them here and kind of reveling in the fact that they don't understand them, and there's this touch of fear to them. Mm-hmm. I think as adults, we just put a blind eye to those things now.
Mm-hmm. I remember all the myths that you learn in the playground or in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
like this.
Sure.
That you mustn't get near the dragonflies or they sew your ears up and all.
Right.
I mean, really. It's amusing now, but I think these are things that...
Yeah, powerful.
They're really... And I love her... she used one word at the top of the second page. It was what we knew best, understood least. Mm-hmm. It whipped through our bodies like fire or sleet. I just think that's...
Yeah.
I like that she chose whipped. That's... Because it suggests something else to be afraid of.
Right.
But it also that, that you could never explain it to anyone. But mm-hmm.
It's working in life for her.
Things that were
even if it's past, it's very on the front burner, you get the feeling. Mm-hmm. You got a hand.
Well, I was just going to say, she seems to emphasize we were afraid.
Right.
Sure.
But now we have learned those are not quite as threatening as we felt they were.
Okay. Where does she make the hinge bit from the were to the now?
I don't know if she does.
Mm-hmm.
I think waiting is present tense.
The restless wind-driven
I think that's the best she does at the end there, about the very end. And there's a sense of hopelessness again there, like you mentioned, Mom, with these seagulls kind of, it's like almost a landfill image of kind of a rotting
low tide or something, crumbling edge of the continent, we stood waiting to be saved. But then the stood, I think there's some ambiguity there. Is it, when were they standing here?
A whole lot of that whole last stanza sounds like a beach thing. Mm-hmm. They really look, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Which is kind of interesting. You didn't get that feeling as much.
It's a very genuine poem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so
very personal.
Dorianne Lux read for our community.
Did you?
Last month. And she told us something about herself, and she really did grow up in a very desperate family situation. So that these lines about we were afraid of what we were to become, you know, knowing that, you know, you could just see it in the people around you, that's what I'm going to be.
And what mothers sometimes say to daughters, you're
yeah.
going to become
and
blah, blah, blah.
Like, yeah.
I think one of the interesting things to me is that it's a poem about shared fear. It isn't just I,
right?
Right.
It really is she and her sister, or
yeah.
the right, whoever the persona of the...
For all the children.
For all the children.
Yeah.
And there is a hinge, I think, in the poem where she goes up to it and then goes away from it. At least that's my feeling of the energy of the poem. In which she goes up to first the meat sliding into the pan, and then the soundless swing of the father's ringed fist,
mm-hmm.
the mother's face turned away,
mm-hmm.
and then the wet bed, anything red.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like she can't stay there, and she has to move to less, you know, to other memories. And so that's,
yeah.
you know, just sort of.
Sure. She will. It got very personal, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right up and said, here's this, and then, oh yeah, and then there was all these other things, and then she would deal with it, and then, yeah, and I see the, well, I don't know, the end of the poem seems to me to sort of take them out of the particular into another realm where they're looking at the sea as a kind
mm-hmm.
of, is a, it's on a different metaphor.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, I may be misreading this last stanza, but I almost read it as we were afraid of waiting to be saved, the endless wind-driven waves. I mean, the beginning of the stanza, you know, we were afraid.
Right.
And it's not clear to me that there's any, I mean, that's still within this incredibly pervasive world of fear.
Mm-hmm. Waiting to be saved from fear.
Yeah.
Waiting to be saved from the whole list.
Yeah.
It could, I think she leaves that ambiguity there.
Yeah.
But the sentence, is it all one long?
Yeah.
Yes.
There's no period, is there?
No.
So you could read it that way.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's children.
Her life is endless.
So the stanza is like those waves too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not as hopeful.
Huh? I thought it was interesting. I don't know if there was any other place where she said something like this, but at the top of the second page, we were lured.
Mm-hmm.
Because that feels very genuine to me, this attraction to, you know, things like death. I mean, Halloween is probably the ultimate, but, you know, scary movies or just daring somebody to run, walk through the graveyard at midnight or...
Yeah. Don't you think there's something saving or liberating to name? Just in naming these,
yes.
I don't know, and it would be fun to ask her. The, you know, is there a liberation or a catharsis or a something that happens to transform it just by naming it and listing it? And there's a tradition in Christian faith for that, definitely. Mom.
Well, if you were to illustrate this whole poem, you'd come up with a lot of ugly images.
Mm-hmm.
There's no visual or sensual beauty in it
right.
at all.
Uh-huh.
It just smells bad, or it looks bad, or it's, you know, it makes it all kind of a discouraging
mm-hmm.
picture of where they grew up. Right?
It's detritus.
Yeah, there's a dumpster, definitely.
The dumpster's there. I think it's a very raw and genuine. I love the genuine thing you said. It is. It's raw, it's genuine, it's deep. In there, but there's some humor, I think, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of the genuine. It's
well, when you grow up, you can laugh about it. But
yeah.
if you're a little girl and the elastic breaks on your panties and you're
on the school ground, you can't laugh about it.
True.
Yes. It's see the piece around listing. I think that is cathartic and freeing, but it's spoken in past tense, so it's right. Not a redemption or a freedom or a power that you can have in the moment.
Okay.
I think at least I just felt like sobbing afterwards because it seemed like an extraordinarily fearful existence, not just. I don't know. It seemed all inclusive.
But fairly ordinary. A lot of it, maybe.
I don't know.
Not all of it. But
I don't know.
Some universal. I think there's
sure.
Like you
yeah.
said about it's not narcissistic. There was a way. That's very female, if you could say that. And a lot of the writer's gender comes through. But I felt pulled into it too. Mm-hmm. So it is inclusive. In that way, maybe. Other comments? More?
I just got in a little late on this, but the one kind of redemptive thing to me is that they get in a bus and go someplace,
mm-hmm.
and when they get there, instead of being surrounded by all this small stuff,
right.
they're standing on the edge of a continent.
Mm-hmm.
Looking out at these endless waves. And something about the wind, and maybe I'm just bringing some of my own moments of being in a place like that to this, but it feels like there's at least some movement
I like
from
that.
The place they're stuck in fear to the edge of something.
So looking beyond it, looking away from it the other way. Yeah, I like that. I sit and look out. There's a Whitman thing again.
Well, I noticed that in the last two paragraphs is because she puts a almost negative sense on what we would all consider positive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we all think a trip to the beach, and
right.
that's a fun thing, but yet she turns that around. So I think we can bring our own experiences into it, but she almost, like, plays with that.
Yeah, her fears over our dominant. Yeah.
Because that waiting to be saved part at the end, mm-hmm. I mean, it really does pull at your heart to go back to
yeah.
to what you're saying about how immediate this poem is. Because
mm-hmm.
I think, I mean, my read is this is a poem about, you know, an abusive household. You know, I mean,
yeah.
this is a horrible existence that she went up in. So even something like a trip to the beach mm-hmm. becomes overshadowed by the potential for threat and the potential for danger.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is waiting to be saved. They're powerless.
Yeah.
She and her sister and brothers or whatever. They're kids. And what she's done is give voice to her childhood. the experience of fear in her childhood. I mean, and I think, you know, just to tie it all together, I think what you said is right. Listing it out and saying it out loud it's a brave act. I mean, it's how you overcome fear. And it's a way of reaching out.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a redemptive act, whether or not redemption's ever cut and dried, you know. It isn't, in my opinion. The cross is not, you know, you have these glimmers of what that means. You have these moments of knowing that redemption. It isn't a constant sensation of redemption for most people I ask that about. So, yeah, it comes in these ways. Yeah, Christine?
I find myself just responding with anger that the people who... the adults in her life who
yeah.
were supposed to be there to help her sort some of this out and find hope and understanding
mm-hmm.
in this chaos and cruelty
yeah.
and victimization
yeah.
aren't there. It's abandoned by adults of the children that
right.
I've talked about in this poem. And it makes me very sad. It also makes me very angry. Very angry. Failure of the adult community
right.
to help these children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the adult community witnessing the same.
Yeah.
So if you're witnessing
yeah,
the same, how are you going to pass
yeah.
that hope to your child?
Sure. Well, the adults in this community, her parents, for instance, but they never think of the wider community or
yeah. But you think of, to keep it
to bring it back to the redemption, and that that it, that angst is there, and the anger is appropriate. But I do think there's that. It kept coming back to me when I put this poem in the focus that I'm doing here. What do the angels say to the shepherds? Fear not. All through the scripture says that. Fear not, for God is doing this, God is doing that. And whenever God was up to this kind of salvation or liberation or freedom, don't fear. Because fear is so deep in everyone. And we find all sorts of ways to cover it up or avoid it or not talk about it or not list it. But it's there. And fear is one thing that maybe, you know, calls for our own need for where do I need to be freed of the fears that I have. Then we'll go on, because we could go on. These are, you know, and I don't seek resolution, okay? If you want resolution on poems, then you got to write a paper, 10 pages or so, and I'll look it over, and it won't be done, because you'll have to revise. But resolution for poetry, I think I had a philosophy professor in college who, when we got into these kind of discussions, and it seemed like we better go on to something else, he had this phrase he'd throw in there every so often. He said, well, that's something you ought to think about for 20 years or so. I thought, that's the greatest. And it put it in this perspective. Think about that for 20 years or so. Kind of true. Fork. Charles Simic, there's actually a book of Simic's poems in the bookstore, which is, I thought was pretty cool. This strange thing must have crept right out of hell. It resembles a bird's foot worn around the cannibal's neck. As you hold it in your hand, as you stab with it into a piece of meat, it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird, its head, which, like your fist, is large, bald, beakless, and blind. Some humor, dark humor. Strange thing must have crept right out of hell. I had that feeling. I thought of this poem up there on the tailings today when I was, there's, Maury's been up there, some of you, when Karin was up there, that there's one huge pile that's half the size of this room and about as high as these beams. Just wonderful stuff. It's like something out of hell, and it's twisted and it's mangled and it's raw. And you were up there too, Dale.
But it's beautiful.
But it's beautiful if you want to see that. And it leads. I had the feeling with some of these objects today that I was reclaiming them. And it's a Messiah complex or something. But I had a sense that I was, and if you want to see it that way, I was redeeming this thing or reclaiming it or giving it a new identity, giving it a new name, and saying this thing has value.
Aren't you transforming it into a new life?
Me?
Well,
hey, I couldn't have paid him to say
that. It's a lot of pressure.
But when an artist or when a person writes a poem or brings it to a new form, it is looking at something, and we look at people as junk, as garbage. And that's
the East Harlem poem, maybe, yeah. And the fear poem. Keep going.
I lost my train of thought. I'm one that has it and loses it as fast as it's there.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I'll have another thought. I'm not
going to. I gave you a coupon to interrupt me. One free coupon for interrupting me. What's this got to do with redemption, this fork thing? It is possible to imagine. There's a key there, and it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird. I really think it has to do with our own inhumanity to each other. But this is the reason I picked it, and I'm infusing some of that in there, I think, but the fact that
we need to save ourselves. We need to be saved from ourselves. There's a lot of, we think about the rest of the world needing to be saved. And in some ways, how do we need to be saved from ourselves, Mari?
Could it also be, you know, how the devil holds the thing?
The pitchfork?
Symbolic
of that. Cool, I hadn't thought of that. The pitchfork, yeah. That is a demonic symbol, isn't it?
Well, the first line, the strange thing, wants to prep right out of hell.
Mm-hmm.
Redemption we have in our Christian faith pulls us out of the depths of hell.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Grace, forgiveness.
Yeah.
The sins and the mistakes we've made.
So is the fork trying to take us back? Getting
well,
too literal.
That's a good point, yeah.
I wonder if he's a
vegetarian. It's a vegan litany. Vegan
Well, I think I've forgotten your name, but what this gentleman was saying in the back about, you know,
Maury.
Reclaiming an object as an artist, or,
oh,
you know,
Dale.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, almost in a sense, the poet is giving us a new way of looking at the world.
I agree.
So whether, regardless of the content of the, you know, of the piece,
mm-hmm.
he is opening our eyes.
Sure. He redefines the fork.
Yeah.
He gives it a whole new life, like Dale was saying. You can claim it and reclaim it. I found a spoon up there today, too, that was, it looked, I don't know, is that a sugar spoon?
Yeah.
Or is that
baby
a
baby spoon?
I wondered if that had been a baby spoon. In that same pile I was just telling you about. This usually I don't polish things, but I think I want to polish this just to see what else you might see.
HD on it.
Does it say it?
I don't know.
See if you can see it. I need more light to see what that meant. But I thought of the fork, and then I found the spoon. And then I was in the dish team today, too, and I had a whole bunch of forks. We ran out of forks, and we had to go out and get forks. And I thought, oh, there's that fork poem. It must crept right out of hell. And it has to do the huge pot. Yeah, more.
What do you think of the imagination not being able to come up with a beak or eyes?
Yeah.
You know, you got the fork, you start imagining it as a bird's foot, you start imagining it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird, but it's a bird.
But it's maybe not possible.
That word blind does it. I mean, that's just...
Blotch.
Mm-hmm.
Blind, did you say it?
Blind? No, blind.
Yeah.
Cold.
It's head. I think the key too is when it becomes its head, like your head. There's this sudden, now it's like me. It's not just the bird, it's how am I? Like that bald, beakless, blind, you know, the fist, my fist holding this fork. There's a connection now between the eater, the holder of the fork, and whatever it is that died on your plate.
The vegetarian poem.
There's a question there. Karen.
I was actually just noticing the fact that it's a fork, and they bring in the images of fork being a bird's foot, and then they say cannibal, and then you think of what you eat with a fork.
Uh-huh.
And you eat birds.
Bingo.
With a fork.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
And the cannibal
like
is like around the neck. You know. What do you make of that?
I don't know, the bird eating itself. So, I don't know. It's just interesting symbolism in there. That,
food chain, something about food chain.
Yeah.
Something about. I thought of E.E. Cummings' poem, Pity This Busy Monster, Man Unkind, Not. He splits the line at knots. Pity this busy monster, man unkind, instead of mankind. He's putting a man unkind. Next line, not. Don't pity this busy monster because we're so busy doing this.
Well, and it seems like I feel like the last two lines we're talking about unconsciousness. You know, that our unconscious violence or inhumanity or you know, participation with this object from hell.
Mm-hmm.
And then that you think about a fork as being so intimate, put it in your mouth,
right.
Like the baby's doing.
And food is intimate, true. In prison, I work in a prison in my day-to-day job, and forks all have to be plastic. Knives or no knives, it's a weapon.
You can't take it on an airplane
there's
anymore.
There's a sense in the poem, it's a weapon too.
Right, airplanes, these are plastic now.
There you go, security. Fear. Let's go to the next one.
This class is a real downer.
What? Well, that's a loser thing.
Yeah. What does sister can say that?
I think I want to go next to the James Tate Forum at the back because it has a connecting theme there, maybe. I'll go to the one at the very back of the booklet called Creatures. James Tate is a probably one of my mentors' mentors, so I picked this one, but it also has, I think it works here, Creatures. And we talked about the creator yesterday, the first article. See what this might have to do with the second article. The kids were playing in the barn. They'd trapped a rat and were poking it with a rake and a broom. The rat was racing back and forth, and occasionally standing up on its haunches. They knew it was okay to kill the rat because rats ate the grain. The rat would stop and stare at them as if pleading for mercy. Horton landed a good whack, and the rat was dragging one of its hind legs now. Then Theo clobbered him. He was an easy target now. "Let's stop this," Horton said. "Rats have to be rats. They didn't choose to be rats. This guy right here might be the Mother Teresa of rats, or the Muhammad Ali of rats, or the Franklin Roosevelt of rats. And who are we? Little nobodies with a rake and a broom." And with that, they left the barn and headed down to the pond for a swim. One of the ducks was quacking, quacking, quacking. "Frank Sinatra," Theo said. That's like Dale said, you can make it, you know, you can take that and call it something else, and it can be that in the imagination, can it? The duck is all of a sudden Frank Sinatra. Theo maybe saw a light that he hadn't seen, maybe. Little bit of liberation there for Theo. What else do you think of this? Yeah?
Well, what I think about, first off, is how that crucifixion began with soldiers who are downtime in the Roman Empire.
Right. Good.
Finding a rat and stringing it up on a crossbar.
Wow.
And just taunting and torturing a rat until it died. And they got great amusement out of doing that.
And
that
time.
Was the origin of crucifixion.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating that your mind went to that. That's great. It's powerful. Anybody else? And redemption, obviously.
How much pain little nobodies can inflict.
Yeah, little nobodies.
When little nobodies decide to gang up together, they can really inflict a lot of pain.
Yeah. Kids playing. Mm-hmm. This is playing, all right? First line, playing. What's the title?
Creatures.
The kids are creatures too, aren't they?
This is somewhat believable because they're children.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, and if the story had the same kind of turn in it, but the characters were adult, I'm not sure it would be as believable.
Yeah. A lot of James Tate poems start out this way, and then they take these leaps of just wild things. So if you like it and you like James Tate, you get a whole huge doses of that. Karin, are you stretching your...
Oh, yeah, sorry.
It's okay. Stretching's good.
But if the kids had been adults, the rat would have been dead, no questions asked.
Right.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been play. Yeah.
I kind of wondered about soldiers. When they're confronted with killing another person, if they don't think this is a person like I am, they have a mom, they have family, you wonder if those things ever enter soldiers'
minds. Yeah. I have this map of Israel in my peripheral vision over there, that's thinking of that, what they were talking about, too.
But the other thing is, they're probably too late. I mean, it's dragging its hind legs, and then Theo clobbered him. I mean, the rat's going to die. It's probably going to be eaten by something else now. I mean, it's too late for the rat to live.
Too late for mercy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But also, he chose to have it a rat that they're tormenting.
Right.
And the other day, a bunch of little kids were poking at one of the chipmunks.
Right.
And I will admit that I had a very different feeling about the right. chipmunks than I would about a rat.
Or, yeah.
You know?
It's true.
Yeah. Or when boys will take apart, take the legs off of spiders, you know, and torture the spider. Yeah.
I think just kind of going off of that, there's a lot of insight in the line. They knew it was okay to kill the rat because the rats ate the grain.
Right.
You know, there's a certain thing that you're taught when you're a child, I guess, not necessarily actually taught, but that is almost instinctive about what kind of life is you should respect and what kind of life is just,
yeah.
you know, dispensable.
Mm-hmm. A creature hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is.
I like that. There is a bit of hope. There is a little realization for Theo, I think.
Hey, these ducks is Frank Sinatra.
He's trying, he sees a little glimmer, and maybe that's where salvation and liberation and a new thought or a new way of seeing, maybe that's how these things happen, just in a little glimmer. I don't think the big lights, the spotlights don't go on for most of us very often. It's a little bit here and a little bit there. Hopefully adds up.
I will say that I don't know if it's intentional, but that was distracting to me because I immediately thought of the rat pack.
Yeah, I
oh, did you?
That's
interesting. It's probably there.
No, I'm
serious.
Funny.
Yeah,
you're
probably right.
Trying to change the whole thing. That's good. That's what Tate would like. The one I thought of is that when, and who are we? He's such a preacher when he says that. And who are we?
I like that too.
What is man that thou art mindful of?
Yeah.
I
don't know. The first thing I thought is Horton is the first one to clobber this poor little rat. And then he's the one after Theo does it to go, oh, guys, stop. I don't know. There's no like meaning to that, I'm sure, but it just made me wonder about Horton.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Okay. Actually, had it down. It's not until you've done something stupid or painful or cruel that you can feel it and suddenly have contrition. I mean, if you've never inflicted pain, you don't know that. Then you don't need to go and ask. You don't know how to ask for forgiveness.
Right. Good. I brought a video. I'm hoping to find a slot for showing it. That is, it's kind of a. It would be gravy, but Orson Welles narrated the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and they took the one of the animators for the Yellow Submarine, who did the Beatles movie years ago, took this narration and got Orson Welles to do it with Gustave Doré engravings of the Ancient Mariner, Coleridge's poem, which is fits very much in with some of these themes and. Redemption and sanctification and creation. I think it's a beautiful poem in that regard, but it's maybe 40 minutes or so. I'm hoping we can find a time to show that. And if you like, most of you probably know The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even I was thinking about Charlotte's Web when it came out, and this big discussion about when you couldn't have a book like that. You know, was it okay for that to be a child's book? Well, you didn't like that idea because of all the things that were in the critters that were in it, and rat and sin him. He's a viable person in Charlotte's Web.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. And his writing was so good, write for so many audiences. Yeah.
One thing I think is kind of important is that it wasn't just a rat that was just kind of random. It wasn't some animal that's okay to kill, but was just sort of being not doing any harm. This rat was actually taking their grain.
Right.
I mean, it seems like that's a bigger step to give leeway or to love a creature that harms you than a creature that just is sort of doesn't matter.
It's being a rat. God made it to be a rat, right? That's what he's saying. Rats have to be rats. Hawks have to be hawks. They go and eat the mice. Food chain, but yeah.
Because we have to give up something then.
Mm-hmm.
And the rat is a prisoner. The rat does need liberation, doesn't get it, but maybe Theo gets a little bit. I think we're gonna have to stop there, but I really urge you to read the dictionary poem, the Ode to the Dictionary. Some, if you were here yesterday, we had the Ode to, which one was it? Ode to?
Things?
Things, Ode to Things, Pablo Neruda. This is a follow-up on that, Neruda, about the dictionary. And I really like that saving word idea, the word that saves, and that the power of the word, which is what we're really looking at here in poetry, is the healing power of the word and the saving power in this particular session. And to close, I'd just like to have you remember that one passage in Luke, where the road to Emmaus, did not our hearts burn when he talked with us on the road and explained to us the scriptures, that the words, and that's all after the fact, it, you know, they were so in awe when it was happening, and then he's gone, and then they said, oh, man, that was, didn't it burn in our hearts the way he spoke to us on the road? And it's cool that it's on the road, too. They're going along, and they're not sure where they're going. They're very befuddled disciples, and forlorn and lost and fearful, like most of us spend much time doing. It's part of life, isn't it? So we'll stop there and continue tomorrow morning, and I appreciate your participation. You're a great bunch of poetry participants.